97.9 FM, WCHL, and chapelboro.com present The Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show dedicated to getting your community educated, hired, and inspired. The Art of Potential combines real-world knowledge and expertise aimed at helping our community reach their full potential. Now, The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemstra. Welcome to the Art of Potential show. We have a fascinating show today. We are talking with Don Osborne. Don is the founder and owner of Enquarta. And Don, why don't you tell us a little bit about what your company does?
Thank you, Kristen. I would love to. So Enquarta is my publishing platform online where I help college students who are wanting to get into graduate school, and specifically medical school, dental school, law school, and MBA school. And what I do is I have a series of online courses available for students to help them navigate the travel, the difficulty, the maze that exists when it comes to getting into graduate school.
And this is such a hot topic because people who have listened to the Art of Potential show know that we spend a lot of time talking about college admission because it's something that a lot of the community is involved in at some point in some stage as they live here. But graduate school is a whole different ballgame. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the differences, Don, between undergraduate and graduate admissions?
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. So the biggest difference between undergraduate and graduate admissions comes from the structure of graduate school, meaning, the graduate school program that you're probably applying to is either pre-professional or already in a professional track. They're much more interested as an admissions committee in hearing your professional goals and your future vision than they are in hearing stories about you from the point of view of your character, your personality.
Yeah.
And that's different from what undergraduate school
Absolutely.
Did. Undergraduate school, you probably wrote, a heartwarming essay about you as a human being.
Yep.
And you can do that a little bit in your graduate school applications, but you also really want to make sure that you answer the question, why do you want to go to graduate school during your application process? And you want to answer it in a way that makes sense for a career path.
And that was so eloquently put because, to your point, we do see with the undergraduate essays and things like that, they really are looking to, they do want some of your goals, but they really want to know that you're a thoughtful person and that you can write. That's
yeah,
a big
exactly.
thing. So graduate school, they're really, it makes sense looking for someone who's very focused because graduate school costs a lot of time and money. So let's make sure that we get a good fit that way.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
The admissions process, especially for the allied health professions,
yep.
is so dramatically different from undergraduate. Now that's worth mentioning as well. The undergraduate school admissions process is, an application, maybe an interview, and you're done. But for the medical school, dental school process, it's a multi-step process. It starts much, much earlier, starts at the beginning of summer as opposed to fall, and it lasts much, much longer. You apply early June to medical school, you may not find out that you're going to be accepted until the following March or April, 10 months later. It's a much, much longer process. MBA school, also quite a bit different than undergraduate programs, because in MBA school, you're writing not one, not a couple essays, but you're writing literally 10, 15, 20 pages of content for every single application in order to promote yourself as a viable candidate.
It just tires me out when you talk about all that. but let's get into this. It's a lot of stuff, and it's a good hoop that people have to jump through, because if I'm tired listening, then I'm probably not a good candidate for any of these programs. But having said that, so do you have a sense of how many students are moving from undergraduate work to graduate work?
Yeah, absolutely. For example, every year in the medical school application arena, you're looking at something like 100,000 or so students who are actively pursuing the idea of applying to medical school. And of that 100,000, probably 50,000 of them generate applications. And the numbers are comparable for law school, dental school, and probably double that for MBA school.
Okay. So there are a lot of students who are leaving their undergrad world and saying, all right, I'm not done yet. Are they, in your opinion, from what you've seen in your client base, are they saying that because they're scared to go into the workplace or because they really feel like they need, well, obviously medical school, they need this to move on? My question would be more related to MBA and law school applicants.
Well, I'd love to tell you a funny story about this, because when television shows, popular television shows, are related to the law, law school applications go up.
Law and Order, when, bam.
Law and Order, bam. Amazing. When medical school or medical shows come up and can become very popular, like, you know, House and Grey's Anatomy, medical school applications will go up. But I think the larger issue really is an economic one, because when people, human beings, whether it's a student or the student's parent, when they start to, you know, hear and see and read in the media that, oh, the economy is tanking and, you know, things are difficult job-wise, it's an easy decision to make for a parent or for a student about to transition away from college to say, well, maybe I'll take a few extra years, I'll stay in school, I'll get a graduate degree, and by then the economy will have turned around and my job prospects will be brighter. So those are some of the reasons that are most common.
Yeah, there, and that makes sense. It kind of is a, if you have the money to do it, it's a safety net until, like you said, the economy picks up, you're hopefully making yourself a more desirable hire, also probably increasing your opening salary bid at that point as well. So let's talk about some of the good prep schools, because one of the things that I see a lot, I deal a lot with undergraduate admissions, is people already know at the undergraduate and even at the high school level that they plan on pursuing some type of graduate work at some point. Mm-hmm. Do you recommend kids start thinking about graduate school in high school? And I realize that sounds kind of silly, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I here's what I recommend. I recommend that a high school student start answering the question, what is their purpose or what is their vision?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to take it on kind of like, you know, what do you want to have for lunch? In other words, I don't want it to be this big, you know, this big wrenching kind of agonizing existential question that I have to deal with if I'm 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I want to be more playful with it. And I want to give high school students an opportunity to say, well, I don't know what I want to do with my whole life, but right now, if you were asking me today, I want to be a blank, or my purpose for my life is blank.
Right.
And, you know, when you start to get articulate around these topics, things get a lot easier, because you can, you know, I keep telling my clients, you know, just try on a sentence like you would try on a sweater, you know. You know, my purpose is to, you know, deliver 10,000 babies, and my career is a doctor. Great. Does that really land well for you? If it feels good, then maybe, you know, carry it around for a while. If it doesn't really work, you get to switch.
Right. And, you know, there's no big investment.
So I want you, you know, I want to audition, and I want you to shop for your purpose all the way through high school and well into college.
Yes. That sounds good. And what, where I was kind of going with the question is the, what I see for the kids, for example, who we're surrounded by medical communities here. We've got Duke Medical School, we've got UNC Medical School. Mm-hmm. And so we see a lot of kids coming out of that environment. It is their culture. It's what their parents do. It's what they see themselves doing. So they, in a sense, they have shopped. They have gone there and they've said, I see myself going into medicine. And what we're seeing them backing up all the way at the high school level is saying, okay, if I want to do this and I want to go to these schools, then I need to be doing this piece now. And I think that's just an important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, it really, really is. And I would also add, you know, it's important that you do the things that you need to do, whether you're a high school student or a college student, in order to improve your candidacy for medical school. And just a couple of quick examples, right? You want to, you know, have some kind of patient contact exposure where you're probably volunteering in a hospital setting or you're shadowing a doctor. You want to be able to confirm that this career path is meaningful to you. And it's not just a romantic idea.
Yes.
But also, you really want to practice answering the question. In the case of, let's say, you know, I want to be a doctor, or I want to be a dentist. You want to be able to answer the question why you want to be a doctor, why you want to be a dentist, in a way that's different from I want to help people. And you want to have as much specificity around your career path as possible. And you want to practice that so when it comes time to either write it down in an application or speak it during an interview, you can really stand out and you can show that you have, you know, a substantial amount of introspection and thought through your motivation.
That is great advice, regardless of where you're applying to school, medical school or MBA or even undergraduate. Wonderful advice. I want to talk actually more about that, but let's do that in our upcoming segment. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I'm talking with Don Osborne. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra. You are listening to The Art of Potential show. Be sure to check us out on Twitter at Art of Potential or on Facebook. Right now, I am talking with Don Osborne. We're talking about graduate school admissions. Fascinating conversation. A lot of parallels here between undergraduate, but yeah, graduate school is so much more of a life commitment, I think, at this point. So, Don, you were just telling us about the interview process. So are most graduate schools interviewing at this point?
Yes, most of them are, with the exception of law school, which does not yet include an interview.
Well, that's interesting now, isn't it? Well, okay, so let's talk about some of the ethics interview questions that come up for other professions besides law school candidates. So what are some of the ethics questions that a student who is looking at, say, medical school would be asked to answer?
Well, certainly the classic ethics questions regarding euthanasia and abortion are prevalent. They're not only prevalent in at the admissions process, but they're certainly a big deal conversation in the whole arena of medicine and, you know, what our responsibilities are as physicians in providing care to our patients.
Well, it goes against the Hippocratic Oath in a lot of ways, so I can see where there would be some ethics around that. That would
certainly has the potential, depending on the context, yes.
Yes. So when you are coaching students to answer these questions, can you give us some examples of great responses to interview questions and some that are pretty standard but aren't going to wow anyone or take them anywhere?
Sure, I would love to. So I guess the number one thing for me is if I'm going to be answering a question regarding, let's say, you know, what are my views on abortion, and I'm in an interview environment, the number one piece of advice that I can give the student is to be authentic and to be truthful to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, you know, a lot of students come to me and say, you know what, I'm really afraid if I say, you know, if I have one point of view or the other point of view, I'm really afraid that I'm going to get in trouble. The interviewer is not going to like me. And if the interviewer doesn't like me, then I'm not going to get a good vote in terms of admissions committee. If I don't get a vote on the admissions committee, then I'm not going to get accepted to medical school. If I don't get into medical school, I won't be a doctor. If I'm not going to be a doctor, then my career is over. If my career is over, my life is over.
Right.
I feel fat, you know?
That's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure. So what I want to do is I want to take that pressure off the student by saying, look, be authentic with yourself. And it's a really good idea that you have a point of view. And for the purposes of the interview specifically, you're not going to have enough time to contextualize every possible scenario regarding abortion.
Right.
So I recommend it's much easier if you just take one side of the argument or the other. You're either, you know, pro-life or pro-choice, for example, and you just stick to it and let that be okay for the, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of conversation that you have. At least if you do it that way, at the very least, you get two benefits. Number one, you can kind of relax into your answer because you're not going to change your mind.
Right.
No matter what the interviewer says in terms of challenging you, you're not going to change your mind. That's number one. So at the very least, you can be comfortable and confident in your answer and speak authoritatively that this is my point of view. This is how I feel, period. And number two, at least the interviewer is going to acknowledge you for taking a clear position. Not going to be wishy-washy. You're not going to be contextual. There's no relativism in terms of your answers. And so, you know, whether the interviewer agrees or disagrees with you, really kind of irrelevant. The interviewer is at least going to applaud you for having a point of view. I think the big danger here is that a lot of students are afraid of having any point of view, and so they come across as having no point of view, which results in, you know, a little note in your file that says wishy-washy.
And we don't want to be wishy-washy. It's not a good thing.
The problem is that, you know, at this stage, you want to start having beliefs and values regarding your career path. Not having one is kind of a little bit of a yellow flag.
Yeah. No, I could see that, especially when you're about to commit all that time and money into the profession you're going into. So in addition to questions of an ethical nature, what other types of questions are you seeing just across the board from MBA programs, from dental programs? What kind of other questions are you seeing interviewers ask?
Well, there are two things. First, the number one question that students get asked all the time is why?
Why are you applying?
Yeah, you know, why do you want to do this? So after the icebreaker question of tell me about yourself and, you know, let me have a little bit of background and let's talk about, you know, your favorite hobbies or what have you. After that's all done, then the why question, I think, is a legitimate question. Why do you
Absolutely.
Want to be a doctor? Why do you want to be a dentist? Why do you want to be a pharmacist, et cetera? Those are legit questions. Answering the question with some specificity, some clarity regarding your purpose, I think is really essential. And we were talking previously about, you know, starting to practice that kind of conversation very, very early in order to get comfortable with yourself and with what you really believe. Because I know we all feel it in our hearts. We really have a strong feeling about wanting to serve, wanting to support other people. That's not hard. The hard part is putting that in words
Yes.
in a way that is both authentic to yourself and is convincing, something going beyond just this sort of generic idea of wanting to help others. You and I have been both help people, you know, by right. doing anything. It's not just a matter of being in the allied health profession. We could be doing anything and help people. So something specific really makes a big difference.
And to
so
your,
that's the big category of question that I see.
And to your point, when something is not clear, you can't put words around it. You just simply can't because you don't know the words to assign to it. So if your desire is not clear as to why you want to go to medical school, you are going to sound a little bit confusing or a little bit gray or opaque in your answer. But it is much clearer when you can explain why and give good examples as to why. I think for what I've seen in just really good essays and in really good interviewers is the very specific, what other people would kind of glaze over or gloss over the this, you know, a good interviewer will then pick that up and carry that around and say, this is my story. It's a storyline. I think stories work well in things like that. So, okay, so we've got the interview going. What about recommendations? Are medical schools looking, well, actually, let's back up before recommendations. Talk to me about grades. What do your grades have to be to get into an MBA or a medical school, dental school? What's their cap? What are they looking for?
Well, let me separate off the MBA side.
Okay.
From the rest of the program.
Okay.
So generally speaking, in the allied health professions, you really want a 3.5 or 3.6 GPA in the sciences in order to be a competitive candidate. And those numbers can vary a little bit depending on your circumstances and where you apply. Some schools are more flexible regarding GPA. Some schools are, you know, really after super high GPAs. So you want to, you know, do your due diligence and research each individual program. So that's the main thing regarding GPA for the allied health professions, for, say, a psych program, for law school, and so on. MBA school is rather, rather different because MBA schools generally looking for at least 2 to 3, perhaps more, years of full-time professional experience that begins after you graduate from college. And so you could think about your resume or the professional experience that you've had as kind of a little bit of a transcript or a report card that MBA schools are going to look at, and they're going to evaluate your candidacy on what kind of experiences you have and therefore what kind of contributions you can make into the MBA program. So the undergraduate GPA becomes less of an essential criteria. It does matter if you still right. you want to have a decent GPA, but you can, you know, find good MBA programs that will take GPAs as low as 3.0 all the way up.
Well, and that's an interesting way the MBA program's looking at it then. So they're looking at the person coming in as actually part of the educational experience. So they're seeing mm-hmm. the person coming in as adding value to the program itself.
That's exactly right.
So in your experience, what are some of the interesting MBA applicants you've seen go through the process?
Well, a couple great stories. One is I had an applicant who was given fairly early in his career pretty substantial authority regarding a venture capital fund that he was managing.
Oh, okay.
And this is a small boutique venture capital firm that he worked for. And he was relatively young. He was like 3 years out of college or thereabouts. And he was given decision-making authority over this particular fund. He evaluated several different small businesses and decided to invest in one for the tune of $16 million. He lost the $16 million on behalf
of
the fund.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was his story for his MBA school admission.
Why I need an education.
You know what I mean? It's like, look, I've had this experience, and this, you know, obviously, losing money in a venture capital fund is much, much more of a common problem than making money in a venture capital fund. So that's a very valuable experience. It's a little counterintuitive.
Yes, because that's not why people get into venture capitalism, but it is a risk. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking more about how to get admitted into graduate school programs. You are listening to the Art of Potential program with Kristen Heemstra.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra. You are listening to The Art of Potential show, and I am talking with Don Osborne of Encorda.com. So, Don, can you tell us quickly how people, if they want to know more about your program, where do they find you?
Well, you can find me on my website at Encorda.com. I would be happy to talk to anybody. If they want to email me, they can email me at dono@encorda.com. And that's the best way to reach me. I'm on email all day long, and email is best.
And we'll also have this information on the Art of Potential website, too. So artofpotential.com, you can listen to the show, and you can link through to Don as well. So, all right, Don, so talk to us about testing. How important is testing for the admissions process?
Well, certainly it is the one universal objective measure of every student. You and I, Kristen, may have gone to different undergraduate programs, different schools. We may have had different majors. Your instructors may have been much harder graders than my instructors, so our GPA could be radically different.
Yep.
But if we're both taking the same standardized test, then supposedly, allegedly, our numbers are good numbers to compare one of us against the other. So that is the assumption and the belief behind standardized testing, and that's why standardized tests like the MCAT, the DAT, the LSAT for law school, and the GMAT for MBA school, that's why those tests exist, and that's why they're so heavily relied upon by all of these programs.
So it sounds like if you do well on one of these standardized tests, even if your GPA isn't up to their normal picture, if you will, they'll be more interested in you because you're testing well. Does that make sense?
I think that's really, really true in the law school and MBA school admissions arenas. I think it's less true in dental school and medical school. And the reason why is because there are so many applicants compared to the number of seats available that medical schools have a wide range of choices. They can pick anybody they want. And so as a matter of just conservative and, you know, being safe around the success of one of their matriculated students, they rather pick somebody who's got strength in both areas.
And who wouldn't? Let's be honest. If you can have both, and why not?
Exactly. You know, the analogy is this. If you're at a bar and you see, you know, a really pretty or a really handsome person, you know, who wouldn't want to, you know, have that person as a date, right?
Right.
You can pick anybody you want to, pick the person that you're most attracted to.
That makes sense. Absolutely. So are there, what are some of the better pre-med schools out there?
Oh, it's a really, really important question because for me, it's a giant myth that there is a better versus a worse pre-med school.
Okay, so break that down for us, because I'm telling you, I deal with this all the time, and it's like, I've got to get into a good school because they're going to have a good pre-med program.
Awesome. So let me give you a classic example, right? So let me pick, you know, a name of a medical school. Let's say it is, super high, super well-known medical school.
Okay.
Super high, super well-known undergraduate school. And this is a super famous school, and it's in a super famous state, and it's well-regarded as having a great reputation. And, oh, my God, everybody who gets in there, that, you know, people around them just really, like, bow down and go, oh, my God, you're amazing. You got into that school?
I think I know the school you're talking about.
Okay, perfect. So now that you're, you know, now that you're there, you know, so you're, let's say, now you're 18, 19 years old, and you're attending this school, and it's cold. It's snowing, and you come from a place where you're not used to cold and snow, or it's hot and it's dry, and you come from a place that's never hot and dry, and you know you're used to a certain kind of you know, day or a certain kind of pattern, and this school doesn't follow that pattern. In other words, you hate it. It doesn't matter.
It could be the culture. It could be a ton of things, but you just don't like it.
Anything. Yep. If you hate it, you hate it. So, you know, you wind up as an undergraduate student hating your undergraduate career. You go through 4 years, you get an undergraduate degree in being miserable, and it completely colors your whole experience. In my opinion, this is just my opinion, that's going to affect your GPA. It's going to affect your application. It's going to affect your outcome. And I think that is far more important than whether this undergraduate program or that undergraduate program has got a better percentage of acceptance.
Okay, so your argument is that you should find an undergraduate institution which you love, you're passionate about, you like the classes, you like the teachers, because if you're happy going to school, then it's going to show in your application, it's going to make your personality come through more, you're going to be more confident as a person going into school, and that is going to give you the certain aura that's going to then say, this is the person we want in our school.
It's going to show up in your aura. It's going to show up in your transcripts.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about very practical pieces of your candidacy. If your GPA is higher than mine, even though I went to a school that starts with the letter H and you didn't, you're probably going to get in before me.
Which is very interesting, and I'm glad you put that out there, because a lot of people believe that if you went to a school that starts with an H or a P or some of the other ones, that is almost an automatic into the medical schools.
Right. And, you know, there's certainly the outcome that we see from the outside perpetuates that belief.
Mm-hmm.
Because we only hear about the success stories. We don't hear about the students that I hear about who come to me saying, look, you know, I've been 3.5 years. I hate it here, but I'm almost done. My GPA is 2.8. I've done nothing except for study and go home. I don't have any experiences because I had to study so hard just to keep up with the material. And I really don't have anything to show for it. Now I want to go into medical school. What you got?
Yeah. Give me those magic beans. Come on now.
Exactly. It's much better. So many times I have parents call me up and say, did I do enough for my son or daughter, helping him or her get into the best possible undergraduate program? And my answer and response is your son or daughter happy? And when the parent says, my son or daughter is deliriously happy, they're having the absolute time of their lives, they're enjoying themselves so much, then I'm saying you did the exact right thing.
Yes, and when the parent says, I don't care, I just want them to get into medical school, then what's your response?
Oh, that's it. All you want to do is get them into medical school, then the best way to get them into medical school is to get them to have a really high, strong science GPA. Do you think that that your son or daughter is going to have a higher science GPA at somewhere he or she hates, where the rigor is so high that it feels cutthroat and highly competitive and painful? Or if your son or daughter is enjoying him or herself, maybe has a social life, maybe the undergraduate program isn't as well known internationally, doesn't necessarily have the most famous football team, but the student's having a great experience, where do you as a parent think that your son or daughter will thrive?
Well, Don, can't tell you how important this is, because we are a community obsessed with names of institutions. It's all day, it's name dropping, it's where so-and-so is going to go to school and da-da-da-da. And we're surrounded by awesome schools here. And so we have that luxury, and it's our culture. This is what we do. This community is an academic community. If you went to New York, people wouldn't care about your academics as much because they're a business community. They have a different focus. But our focus is pretty narrow in that way. One of the things I want to bring up, which is on your website, Encorder.com, is you list some of the great pre-med programs that a lot of people haven't even considered. And I'd like to just bring up a few of those, because it's number four that really got me. So number one, UCLA. You have 820 kids applied for the, I guess they're not kids, but young adults applied for medical school. University of Michigan, no surprise there. UC Berkeley, no surprise. But University of Florida is the next one. And talk to me about that, because that was a surprise for me.
Sure. So this list is the list of schools that have the most undergraduate students who apply out to medical school. So a larger school is probably going to have more pre-meds and therefore more applications. And that's the case with University of Florida.
Okay.
So this is strictly a quantity thing, right?
Okay,
and
right.
Isn't that interesting, you know, that all these different, we talk about, like, the best school for pre-meds, and yet there's no one who's publishing any data around Which undergraduate schools have the highest acceptance ratios to medical school.
No, and I'd love to see that.
The problem with that data? the undergraduate programs cannot possibly track it. It's too difficult.
Okay, see, I would think that the medical schools could track it. I think it could be tracked on the other end.
AAMC could track it for sure. That's a whole other conversation.
Okay. Well, on that note, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll be continuing to talk about how to get into graduate school. You are listening to Kristen Heemstra. This is the Art of Potential Show.
You're listening to the Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra. You are listening to the Art of Potential Show. I'm having an absolutely fascinating conversation with Don Osborne of Encorda.com. Don is, just the kind of guru here on graduate school admissions, and we just talked about medical school admissions. So, Don, what are some sleeper MBA or, sleeper schools for MBA programs that might be out there?
Oh, okay, great. Well, here's what I love to say about MBA programs. There's two approaches. You're either going to be applying to a national top-rated MBA program. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, you probably have, 3 to 5 years of very substantial experience with a good amount of leadership, a great GMAT score, and you kind of already know and you're predisposed to having this sort of top national MBA orientation. So here are the sleeper programs that I just love. If for some reason you either don't have the experience, you don't have the GMAT score, or you just don't want to relocate to another part of the country for an MBA, The sleeper program to really watch for are these regional MBA schools that are amazingly outstanding, that have a fantastic reputation within the state or within the community that they serve, but they're not really well known outside that particular state or that particular area of the country. These MBA programs are what I would call the sleeper programs because, let's face it, you're probably going to work somewhere close
right
to where you either currently live or will ultimately live. And you'd like to have your professional network tied in to that community. So Going to a regional MBA school, a community-oriented MBA school like that, can really tap you into this vast, vast, vast network of professionals, colleagues, faculty, communities, companies, organizations, institutions that you can support and can support you for 20, 30 years.
And you bring up there, just in a nutshell, such a good point, which is when you graduate, one of the things that is so important is your network. So to your point, if you're going to stay local, it makes sense to really invest in the local program because that is the one that's going to have the most people connected to it throughout the community. Excellent advice. Are you familiar with the executive MBA programs, and what do you think of those?
I am. I love the executive MBA programs, but I love them for a specific type of applicant. If you're, let's say, in your late 30s, early 40s, and you have director-level experience, mm-hmm. and you're really looking to build out your professional network collegially at that level, then a key executive presidential MBA program, I think, really makes a lot of sense for you. If, however, you're a more traditional applicant, let's say you're in your mid to late 20s, you've had 3 to 4 years of work experience, you're a mid-level manager, you're moving up in your career path, and you're looking for a way to really augment your educational experience in business, I would not recommend an executive MBA. Instead, I recommend either a regional or a national full-time day MBA program that you can really immerse yourself and have these great opportunities to just discuss, debate, and if you don't mind me saying, argue in class and out of class over really specific business concerns that either you've experienced or that you're going to experience, and you can do it in a way that gets you great outcomes and that you can take that experience with you back into the workplace.
And that's a very good point, well taken. We're seeing around our area, and I think a lot of colleges are embracing this, they're business pods, for lack of a better way of putting it, mm-hmm. where they're trying to create environments for people who are starting, trying to do upstart businesses or trying to get the angel investors. We're seeing a lot of social entrepreneurship come down the pipeline. A lot of folks mm-hmm. are looking at bringing that aspect into the business community. Are you seeing, or what are you seeing in terms of applications for MBAs? Because, and the reason I ask this question is in talking to people who are out in the business community, they are saying that MBAs are less desirable, if you will, than mm-hmm. they were. Like, it used to be an absolute, you got to have an MBA, but they say that the doors mm-hmm. are opening a little bit more on that, and they're seeing even mm-hmm. undergraduates come in with just business degrees. Are you seeing that mm-hmm. at all?
Well, I have a real bias around this, but that's probably because of what I do for a living.
Right.
I first started to see the question around, is an MBA relevant? That question started to get published in popular media in the mid-50s.
In the mid-50s?
Yes.
Okay, it's been around a while.
That question's been around, you know, for as long as I've been around. And I don't think that question's ever going to go away because right. it's a legitimate question.
Right.
If I'm already making $250,000 a year and I'm successful, let's say I work for a pension fund, I have an undergraduate degree, but I'm making $250,000 a year, and I have my life, you know, set up pretty much as well as I want to do, and I'm very happy in my profession, the opportunity cost of getting an MBA is pretty high. I'm going to lose my $250,000 a year, lose my position, lose my seniority. I'm going to have to redo all that after I get out of MBA school. So, you know, there's some reasons not to go. If, on the other hand, you know, you're looking to do either a career change or you're looking to advance yourself, or what you really want is the help that MBA schools promise, which is from their career center to get you access to the right recruiters and
yes.
the right industries
yes.
where you can get a leg up and perhaps be recruited and then made employment offers to with, you know, pretty substantial hiring bonuses. Well, the MBA is the way to go.
And that would be really nice. Everyone, I can see where that would be attractive to everyone if you can come out and you can have job offers with hiring bonuses waiting for you. I
yes.
do know that that's been, at least in talking to some of the people around here, those offers have not been as forthcoming recently just with the economy. So I do know there's been some stress around that particular thing.
It's gone up and down, right? It was really
right.
big in the 90s, and it was
right.
big in the early 2000s, and then credit crisis hit, and things have shrunk, and we're at now where we're at. And I bet you 2 cents, I haven't done this research, but I bet if you do go around MBA to MBA school, you're going to find a lot of regional differences
yeah.
based upon industry.
Okay. That I'll take your word for it. I haven't done that either. Let's kind of, as we're rounding out here towards the end of the show, what advice do you have for young people who are looking at trying to get into these competitive programs? Let's say they're either high school or college age, or even, you know, a few years out of college and looking at going back in. What advice do you have for them?
My big advice for you is to inspire yourself and stay inspired and then start inspiring others with your vision. It's really tempting to get caught up in the muck
Yes.
of admissions and start to doubt yourself and really start to wonder, you know, if you're a qualified candidate. And then you start running around online into, forums where other students are posting all these, you know, doom and gloom.
Yes,
and
they are. They are out
pain.
There.
Yeah. And so you can get mucked up. You can get really invested in the anxiety of it if you really want to, you know, thereby ensuring, you know, the success of the psychology profession for many years to come.
Right.
I really, really recommend that you elevate. I want you to uplift your worth, and I want you to uplift the worth of the future patients or the future people that you'll be working with. And I want you to stay in that, and I want you to inspire yourself so that you can inspire other people, including inspiring the admissions committee that your candidacy is something that you are really excited about, that you really want to do, and that you can't wait to participate in. And as soon as you get out of graduate school, you're going to hit the road running, and you're going to make contributions like gangbusters. That is unlike any other advice I ever hear undergraduate
yes.
students getting relative to
yes.
the admissions process.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And on a different show, we had someone talking about what people notice first in another person, and the answer is energy. It's the first thing we notice. Are you inspired? I love the answer you just gave. Are you excited about yourself and about your future? great, great advice. All right, so that's...
I want to say this really quick.
Please do.
You can be inspired and nervous at the same time. You can be inspired and kind of worried at the same time. Both those things can coexist. That's normal. That's a human being. Focus on the inspiration.
All right, so one more time, can you tell us where people can reach you?
Yeah, you can find all about me at incorta.com, www.incuartalikeTomA.com, or just email me at dono@incorta.com.
And you can also go to the website, theartofpotential.com. We will have links to this show with Don, as well as links to all of his contact information. Please follow The Art of Potential on Twitter and on Facebook. You have just listened to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra.